This is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York Democratic delegates endorse Kamala Harris for the party's nomination for president. We speak to one of them this morning about their call on Monday and the growing support and momentum around the Harris campaign. Before she vaulted to the national stage, Harris served as California's top prosecutor, state attorney general, and was raised by immigrant parents in the San Francisco Bay Area. The New York Public News Network speaks to the Capital Public Radio Bureau in Sacramento for more perspective on her time as California state attorney general and U.S. senator and how that will shape the race. Plus, Harmony in the Woods features House of Waters Friday, a trio incorporating elements of West African jazz, psychedelic, and indie rock. Plus, a Linda Ronstadt tribute in Calicoon. But first, the news from NPR.
NPR News in Washington. I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will speak to Congress this afternoon about Israel's ongoing war with Hamas. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, Netanyahu is on a three-day visit to the U.S.
This will be Prime Minister Netanyahu's fourth time addressing Congress, and there will likely be dozens of Democrats choosing to sit it out. New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says she's wary of giving the prime minister a platform as the war against Hamas continues.
I don't want to affirm or legitimize this with my presence.
Still, Democrats like House Caucus Chair Pete Aguilar say it's important to show up even when you don't agree with everything about Netanyahu's government.
I feel when world leaders come to the people's chamber, it's important that we hear their perspective.
Netanyahu is expected to talk about the importance of the relationship between Israel and the United States. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Biden and Vice President Harris are expected to meet Netanyahu tomorrow. President Biden will address the nation tonight from the Oval Office about his decision to end his reelection campaign. Biden announced the move amid growing calls from Democrats to drop out. NPR's Giles Snyder says Vice President Harris has since secured enough promises from delegates to become the likely Democratic presidential nominee.
President Biden has declined to give any hints about what he might say, telling reporters to watch and listen as he returned to the White House after spending several days recovering from a COVID infection at his beach house in Delaware. Biden has said, however, that he plans to campaign for Kamala Harris and that securing a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas is a key priority.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump will hold a rally today in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's his first since Biden dropped out of the race. Trump is expected to focus on Vice President Harris. He has already criticized her as being more radical than Biden. Trump won North Carolina in 2016 and 2020, but the last race was close. Democrats see North Carolina as a swing state. Stocks opened lower today after big companies reported some rocky results. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 330 points in early trading.
Tesla is running into trouble. Shares plunged in morning trading after the automaker said profits fell 45%. Consumer demand for electric vehicles is slowing, as many still find the cars too expensive. Google shares also fell in early trading. The tech company is spending tens of billions of dollars this year on artificial intelligence, but it says it's more worried about underinvesting in AI than overinvesting. And in Europe, shares in LVMH fell. The world's largest luxury group says consumers are spending less money on designer goods and other splurges.
NPR's Maria Aspen reporting. It's NPR. Typhoon Gaimi is making landfall on northern Taiwan. The Joint Typhoon Warning Center says its top sustained winds are 143 miles per hour. That's equal to a Category 4 hurricane. A new analysis from an environmental advocacy group finds tons of so-called forever chemicals are applied to crops on farms across the U.S. every year. As NPR's Ping Huang reports, the chemicals are used as pesticides.
Up to 35 million pounds of PFAS chemicals are sprayed on U.S. crops each year as an active ingredient in pesticides. That's according to a new analysis of government data by the nonprofit Environmental Working Group. David Andrews with the group says new pesticides are increasingly using PFAS.
They make the pesticides more effective, last longer, which makes them beneficial from a use perspective. But it's those same characteristics that raise concerns from an environmental perspective and a contamination perspective.
Andrews co-wrote a piece about the chemicals in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. The health effects of these newer PFAS and pesticides are largely unknown since they haven't been well studied. Federal regulators recently passed a landmark rule to eliminate some PFAS chemicals from drinking water. Ping Huang, NPR News.
European scientists say that last Monday was the hottest day the world has ever had. The global average temperature was 62.87 degrees. The previous heat record was set just one day prior, on Sunday. Scientists say human-caused climate change is the reason, and it's growing because humans continue to burn fossil fuels. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business works to help simplify the supplies buying process. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A little more than 24 hours after President Joe Biden's withdrawal from the reelection bid shook up the 2024 race, New York's delegates to the Democratic National Convention endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris for the Democratic nomination for president, the party announced Monday. Governor Kathy Hochul and state party leaders held a virtual meeting Monday night to discuss their path forward following Biden's sudden exit. Joining us now is one of those delegates, Ann Hart, who also chairs the Sullivan County Democratic Committee. Ann, good morning.
Good morning.
And when we spoke to you Monday morning for your reaction about President Biden's withdrawal, you were telling us about this virtual meeting that was coming up. Tell us what happened during that call.
Well, it was a great meeting. It was very full. There were lots and lots, you know, almost all the delegates were there. We heard from, of course, Governor Hochul and State Party Chair Jay Jacobs and various other members of the party, elected officials who spoke about their support of Kamala Harris for president. There was a lot of excitement in the room. I've never seen a chat blow up like that in a Zoom call. It was pretty incredible. And before the motion was actually ended up being seconded to endorse her, all hands were up on the Zoom. It was a very exciting meeting. People are very excited to you know, to get out there and work for Vice President Harris. And it was an exciting meeting and a great, wonderful meeting.
And it seems that Ms. Harris has announced she's collected enough delegate pledges across the country to become the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee, with the New York delegates among them. More and more Democrats are uniting around Harris. Do you expect this to continue?
I do. I definitely do. I think that we have a mission this year, and we will work in a united fashion to accomplish that mission, which is to make sure that Donald Trump isn't returned to the White House. And I think that's that's a unifying mission among Democrats and others who don't like his last presidency.
Some delegates have said, and some other political leaders have said, that they've been frustrated with the lack of competition around who would replace President Biden. Do you have that same concern at all, or what do you say to those folks about their perceived lack of competition or perhaps an anointing of her as the presumptive nominee?
Well, Vice President Harris said that she intended to earn the nomination, and I think she's doing exactly that. I wouldn't call it a coronation. There are rules that should be followed. And I can only speak as, you know, a delegate at the very bottom of the food chain here. But, you know, there are rules to follow, and we're following them. I think that if anybody who felt that they would like to run for president, they would have done it during primary season and not now. And it's always very difficult for a member of a party to challenge an incumbent president. That's nothing new in American politics. It's very rarely does it happen that a sitting president has a primary challenge from anybody, especially when he's doing such a great job, which the Biden administration has been doing. So, you know, it's a combination of a lot of things, but just, you know, traditionally, even in the Republican Party, you don't challenge an incumbent president. So there was a primary. There was nobody who stepped up who felt that they were strong enough to beat Joe Biden. There were three candidates. They did not prevail. Their messages just didn't resonate with the majority of Democrats. We had that primary. 14 million people voted. And, you know, to say that the process should be opened up now, this is unprecedented. It's never happened. And, you know, we have to stay within the boundaries of what we've said we've done. And so you don't want to disenfranchise the people who voted in the primary. You don't want to, you know, I'm not saying not to open up a process. Open processes are always very good. But we have 104 days until Election Day. We have someone who has been vice president who has had specific issues that she's tried to work on, and she's been very vocal on the issues that, you know, that she cares about, that we care about. This is a proven person with a national profile. And so I, you know, while I respect every attempt at openness and transparency and deliberation, there are practical reasons too. And so, you know, to them, I say, let's work on it for next time. Let's work on our process. Let's work on our, and make our process even more open and transparent in the future.
We've started to see some polling around Harris and Trump matchup. It's not especially clear about who's leading whom. Depending on the poll you look at, it seems to be very tight. However, in polling, a majority of voters say they are deeply dissatisfied with the state of the country. They say the political and economic system is broken. In short, people who respond to these polls say they want change. Do you think that Vice President Harris represents that kind of change?
That was a really vague sort of description of a poll. And when people say that they want change, what does change mean? What does change look like? Is it a change in the form of government? Is it a change in the nominating process? Is it a change in how government works? I mean, that's kind of a, you know, that's really the question to me, is what is the definition of change? And once you have that definition, how do you accomplish it if everyone agrees that that change needs to happen?
And do you think that having Kamala Harris at the top of the ticket puts the state districts and those folks from your party in a better position to compete and to win, especially in New York's 19th, which is a highly competitive district? There will be eyes on that. It flipped last time. It helped move control of the House to the Republican side.
I think there's a lot of energy surrounding this. There's also a lot of energy surrounding Josh Riley, who is the congressional candidate poised to beat Mark Molinaro and help us regain the House. So we've had a lot of enthusiasm around Josh's candidacy. And from what I'm seeing from people who are signing up to volunteer, who are, you know, writing in or calling, there are people coming out of the woodwork in support for Vice President Harris, wanting to make sure that we win this election. It's exciting to see. It's exciting to be on the end of the emails and the phone calls and hear that kind of energy and excitement. It was excitement for Josh in the beginning, and now it's a little bit more.
Of course, now we're waiting to see who Harris picks as her vice presidential running mate. Do you have any preference there?
It's way above my pay grade, that's for sure. There are some very interesting people. I'm watching it really closely, you know, to see who they are. There are theories about, you know, not scientifically, but politically, scientifically, you know, who it should be. It's interesting to watch. And, you know, we'll soon see. And I'm sure she'll make the right decision. But it's, it's very interesting to see the characters that they're coming up with.
You seem to reflect what's going on within the party, too. There doesn't seem to be a clear consensus among folks about who she should pick. There are different attributes to each, as you mentioned. So we'll wait and see what happens there.
I was at a town committee meeting the other night, and I posed a question to the, you know, these very enthusiastic, enlivened Democrats at their town committee meeting. And we had a very lively discussion, and there was no discourse. It was just really sort of excitement about the possibilities and who might be best and so on. So it was a lively conversation without any discord. And I think anybody would be satisfied with, you know, whoever it is. But just discussing the possibilities was really fun for everybody that night.
Do you think that this sort of discourse, this liveliness, this enthusiasm, is that something you're happy to see now in the race that may have not been there before? And how does that help with some of the prospects moving forward?
It's always very excited to see people enthusiastic and engaged. And, you know, that's how you win elections. And so this is just like a, you know, this is another boost in the arm for people, you know, saying, yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to help and do anything I can, no matter what that is. I can fold papers and stuff envelopes, whatever they're able to do. It's exciting to see people stepping up. And as we get closer to the election, that's going to increase. It always does. And it will again. And that's, you know, that's how, you know, that's, it's really all going to come down to the people who do the volunteering, do the work and get the voters out to, vote their choice. And it's always an exciting time when that happens.
Before we go, President Biden will address the nation tonight from the Oval Office. Is there anything that you want to hear from him tonight?
I don't have any specific thing that I want to hear from him. I'm glad to hear from him. And I know that, you know, as he continues to focus on being president and works in the ways that he can to support Vice President Harris's race for president. You know, he will be the ever calm, measured elder statesman that we love him for being.
Ann Hart is the chair of the Sullivan County Democratic Committee, and she's also a New York delegate to the Democratic National Convention. You'll be heading to Chicago pretty soon. Thanks for joining us,
Ann. Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Ann. And a reminder, we will be carrying President Biden's address to the nation from the Oval Office, NPR special news coverage tonight at 8 here on Radio Catskill. Now, before she was vaulted to the national stage, Kamala Harris served as California's top prosecutor, the state attorney general, and she was raised by immigrant parents in San Francisco. In speeches and in her memoir, the 59-year-old Harris has often cast herself as a prosecutor who fought from the inside for progressive change. Some, however, have criticized her for upholding the status quo, saying she remained silent on state initiatives to legalize marijuana and reduce penalties for certain crimes. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Ian Pickus spoke to Chris Nichols, politics editor at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, for more perspective on Harris's time as California State Attorney General and U.S. Senator.
This is Ian Pickus for WAMC News. While Democrats hope Vice President Kamala Harris can turn around their November chances now that President Biden is out, it's fair to say much of the country is considering what a Harris presidency would look like for the first time. Harris is a former California State Attorney General and U.S. Senator, and her time in those roles is sure to attract a new round of scrutiny as a matchup with former President Donald Trump looms in November. Well, for some context, we called up Chris Nichols, politics editor at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Chris, thank you so much for being here.
Ian, it's great to be with you.
Always good to talk to a fellow state capital political person. So how is the news being received in Harris's home state of California so far?
Well, I think among Democrats, they're sort of re-energized. I think that they looked at Harris as sort of a natural pick, being the vice president. She certainly accomplished quite a bit in California, as you mentioned, being elected twice as attorney general. Before that as San Francisco's district attorney. So I think there is a new energy, at least among her supporters, Democrats in our state.
Does she still retain a strong base and a strong operation in California?
You know, I think California serves as a strong base for really any Democrat. I mean, it's certainly a place where politicians of all stripes come to raise money, in places like Silicon Valley and in Los Angeles. But yeah, I would say that California, certainly, statewide elections, Democrats fare very well And I think Harris can count on quite a bit of support from her home state.
So going back a few decades here, how did Harris get into politics in the first place?
Well, her start in politics is really intertwined with her start in law enforcement. She began her career working as a county prosecutor in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then in 2003, she was elected as the city of San Francisco's district attorney. And after two terms in that position, she won a very close statewide race to become California's attorney general in 2010. And that really launched her career to a new level.
What were some of the things that she focused on and prioritized as AG?
Well, as we think about her career as attorney general, I think it's important to keep in mind that in speeches and also in her memoir, Harris has kind of cast herself as a prosecutor who fought from the inside for progressive change. And she did have some notable accomplishments along those lines as attorney general. For example, she led the effort to create California's first statewide training aimed at eliminating implicit bias in law enforcement. And she also put in place a body camera pilot program for all law enforcement agents working at her attorney general's office to increase transparency. But also during her time as attorney general, and also as she was running for U.S. Senate later in 2016, she was criticized by some on her left for remaining silent on certain reforms. For example, Harris declined to take public positions on ballot measures to shorten certain criminal sentences and also to legalize recreational marijuana. And those reforms, you know, reformers saw both of those efforts as ways to help disadvantaged communities.
Already in this nascent now campaign for president, some Democrats have been drawing a contrast between former President Trump, who's now a convicted felon, and Harris, who was, as you say, known as a prosecutor. Do you think she will play up that aspect of her background in this campaign?
You know, I think she will. I think that's a natural role given her career, her long career as a prosecutor. And I think one very well remembered moment during her time as a senator was her questioning of Brett Kavanaugh during his Supreme Court confirmation hearing. You know, she had some sharp and forceful questions and exchanges with Kavanaugh, exchanges that went viral on social media and further elevated Harris as a national figure. So I think it only, you know, would be natural that she would, again, rely on those prosecutorial skills as she questions Donald Trump in the race for president.
Let's recount now how she got to the U.S. Senate, as you mentioned, the questioning of Kavanaugh in the Judiciary Committee. What was the path for her to leave the AG's role behind and join the U.S. Senate?
Well, she ran for U.S. Senate in 2016 after two terms as attorney general, and she ran against another Democrat in California.
That's right. So Barbara Boxer retired from the Senate, and she faced Loretta Sanchez, who was a member of the House at the time.
And her victory was by a fairly safe margin. It was not a particularly close race. And again, she had already gained a higher statewide profile by serving in that prominent post as attorney general.
So what kind of profile did she build in the Senate in the time she was there?
Well, like a lot of Democrats in the Senate during the Trump administration, you know, she spoke out against Trump's border wall proposal, his decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. She was known for supporting increases to things like the minimum wage. She co-sponsored the Green New Deal. She also supported plans to improve teacher compensation. So she, you know, along with that and her questioning, as I mentioned, of Brett Kavanaugh, those were really the core elements of her time in the Senate.
Now, I want to ask you about some other key figures in California politics. I think it's fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Harris and Governor Newsom have had a long and kind of tangled relationship And, you know, they've emerged, I think, today as political allies, but it's taken a while to get there. And Newsom, of course, was mentioned as a possible stand-in for President Biden before Biden endorsed Harris in this fall election. So what can you tell us about Newsom's profile going into November?
You know, publicly, at least, Governor Gavin Newsom has only been a supporter of his fellow Democrats, certainly for President Joe Biden, also for Kamala Harris. When the news broke about Biden stepping aside and then endorsing Kamala Harris, within a few hours, Governor Gavin Newsom did also throw his support behind Vice President Kamala Harris. So there's really no public daylight between the two. As you mentioned, Newsom, he does have a national profile. He's traveled the country. He's put himself in prominent places, either on national TV networks, speaking to the New York Times for stories, and campaigning. So there's no doubt that he has his own national aspirations. But at least in this moment, he is fully supporting Kamala Harris for president.
Let's talk now about the former speaker, Nancy Pelosi, another high-profile California Democrat who was said to be instrumental in the pressure campaign for President Biden to end his reelection campaign. She has now endorsed Vice President Harris for president. What role do you see Pelosi playing as we go forward into the fall?
You know, I think Pelosi, like Newsom, certainly a very well-known Californian, probably better known on a national stage, given her role as speaker. I think she'll play an important role backing Harris, backing the Biden-Harris administration, talking about its track record, its accomplishments. You know, she is still I think she is a Democrat who has a lot of trust among other Democrats across the country for her leadership and her skill, her political skill. So I think you will see her out on the campaign trail backing both Harris and whoever Harris chooses as a potential running mate in this race for president.
One thing we haven't talked about, Chris, is how Senator Harris did, or now Vice President Harris did, in the 2020 primary campaign. I think she was seen as a potential favorite heading into it before President Biden wound up winning South Carolina and kind of turning the tide. Did we learn anything about her as a public national figure in that campaign cycle that stands out to you?
You know, I think, again, like her questioning of Brett Kavanaugh during those confirmation hearings, she might have been best known during her run for president for her tough questioning of Joe Biden in one of the Democratic presidential primary debates. She certainly brings those skills, again, as a prosecutor to the table. She can bring sharp questions to any debate, and I think we'll see her use those skills as she runs for president.
All right. Let me wrap up by asking you a little bit of an inside baseball question, but it's notable that President Biden has held the fewest number of press conferences of any modern president, and that was part of the reason that people grew concerned, I think, about what his situation was running into this fall campaign for a second term. In the time that you saw Harris as attorney general, maybe around Sacramento, how did she do with reporter scrutiny, press conferences, her public profile, that kind of thing?
You know, I think as journalists, as reporters, we're always a little bit frustrated if we can't True. Have clear access to a politician. So Harris, probably no different from other politicians here in Sacramento. It was difficult to get access and have that time to ask questions. So, you know, I think there would be moments in, you know, in a hallway as she's going to an event where reporters were able to ask her questions. But I think, you know, the Sacramento Press Corps would have liked to have more opportunities. And, you know, that's an ongoing frustration also with the governor here in California, Gavin Newsom.
That was Chris Nichols, politics editor at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, speaking to WAMC's Ian Pickus from the New York Public News Network. After a break, House of Waters.
They will be playing at Harmony in the Woods Friday. We'll have a preview next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Keep up with the newest music from some of your favorite singer-songwriters with Now and Then. I'm Kathy Geary. Check it out. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Nominated for Best Contemporary Instrumental Album at the 2024 Grammy Awards, House of Waters is at the forefront of jazz innovation. They're a trio that incorporates elements of West African, jazz, psychedelic, indie rock, classical, and world music into their unique sound. House of Waters will bring that sound to Harmony in the Woods in Hawley this Friday. Let's take a little listen to some of the Grammy-nominated album. This is Folding Cranes from House of Waters' album On Becoming. Joining us now is Max ZT, one of the band members from House of Waters. Good morning, Max.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. Congratulations on the nomination.
Yeah. It was a bit of a surprise. None of us are making music for that purpose. We're creating to find fulfillment and to share. And so to be able to get a little recognition in that way was kind of a surprise and definitely something we are honored to be receiving.
Tell us about the origins of House of Waters. As I mentioned, you mix a lot of different elements and inspirations into your unique sound. How did you guys come together?
Sure. Well, I play an instrument called the hammered dulcimer, which is a large 100-stringed, 93-stringed stringed instrument that you strike with sticks, kind of like a manual demechanized piano, and it's a predecessor to the piano. So if you think about in the inside of a piano, when you hit a key on the outside, hammers hit the strings for you on the inside. So I have the hammers and I do it all manually. I've been playing this instrument for my entire life and eventually started traveling around the world to study different cultures' music and then, of course, to study the earlier forms of the dulcimer, which is likely a Persian instrument originally, but also spent a lot of time early on in India, studying an instrument called the santur.
Let me just ask you a question. I'm sorry to interrupt, but the hammered dulcimer is not something that most youth that get into music are gravitating toward. Mainly, it's like guitar, drums, or something like that. How did you come to want to be mastering the hammered dulcimer?
You didn't want to be a dulcimer player when you were like six.
It was my second choice.
Yeah, exactly. So I saw it really young. I got really lucky. I grew up in Chicago and saw it. There's a huge American folk music community in Chicago. I saw it in an American folk context and just kind of really gravitated towards it at that age and bugged my parents to let me try it until they eventually caved. And here we are many, many years later taking this instrument into areas that are not quite common for the dulcimer. This is actually the first time the instrument has been nominated at the Grammys, which is crazy, at least as a primary instrument, and especially in the jazz category. You're never going to find this instrument, or rather, you rarely find this instrument outside of the tradition. And that's true kind of throughout all the different versions of the instrument as well. You know, it's a traditional instrument, and so many times it's been kind of set in its ways. But I'm very grateful to the teachers that I've had that have been able to say, hey, this instrument is just like any other instrument. It can do anything you want. You just have to, you know, go at it. And so it's been an incredible journey to explore this instrument into these different contexts.
You've been dubbed the Jimi Hendrix of the hammered dulcimer by NPR, no less.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm not burning the instrument though, so I'll, you know, I'm not going to set it on fire. it's too valuable to me. But yeah, I think that quote was just trying to, talk about, bringing it into a different area of music.
We'll have to have you come over to Bethel Woods, home of the Woodstock Festival, here in our backyard to show that off a little bit. In the meantime, you're going to be at Harmony in the Woods in Holly on Friday with your other trio members. You've got, Moto Fukushima on bass and Antonio Sanchez on drums.
We're actually going to be featuring Keita Ogawa on drums.
Okay.
On this show. And we'll also have the great singer Priya Darshini, who also got a Grammy nomination a couple years ago for her album Periphery. And we're going to do this like co-set. She worked on our record this year for one of the songs on our record this year. We've done stuff with her for many, many years. And so we're kind of doing like a co-bill where we're going to come in and out of her music and our music. And it's just really going to be a beautiful time.
Tell me about recording this album. Did you come in with, you know, a set way of wanting to record, or was there more improvisational jazz kind of influence there?
Yeah, that's a great question. We came in with six songs, six like pretty developed compositions, and in the compositions itself there are improvisational moments, but we started to realize that, you know, so much of preconceived music has very little to do with the moment, because in the end, even if there are solo sections involved, you know, it's pretty planned. And so we were thinking, like, let's get out of the data of the music. Let's just get into the emotion of the music. Let's just get into something beyond, notes. Let's get something beyond the sheet music that's in front of us. So what we did is in between takes, even for the same songs, in between takes, the different songs, we did improvisations, eventually coming up with 14 improvisations, ranging like in 3 to 6 minutes each, more of like a little palate cleanser for ourselves to all of a sudden kind of be focused on, you know, the group sound, and then be able to come back and say, okay, great, I can now like play that B section better or whatever, and not be too focused on the data of it. But if we can kind of lose all of that, that mind component, and kind of focus more on the heart component, the stuff that really got us all involved in music to begin with. Let's see what that does. And we had a kind of an amazing experience doing it. Of the 14, obviously, you know, they're improvisations, so some are better than others in our opinion. But we put four on the album, and actually we're going to be releasing on Ground Up Music, just Snarky Puppy's label, later this fall. I don't even think we've announced this yet. On October 11th, we're going to have a release of a bunch of the other improvisations as well. We're going to label the album The Improv Sessions, and we're going to put out a bunch of these other improvisations. And after listening to them again, we're like, wow, these are actually, they're all pretty awesome. So we're gonna whip that out for the audience and our fans.
And for the audience, in a live concert setting, how do you translate that to and also to this venue outdoors as well? It's kind of like a listening journey you're connecting folks to, as well as like a standard concert, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we've done this before. It's so funny because it's like somebody in the audience, I remember like not so long ago, was like, oh, I should have had my camera up. And then she even herself said, well, wait a minute, like, this moment, the improvisation of creating just for the now, just for the people in the audience, for nobody else, and just to have the experience just like a one-on-one. I mean, that's something that we rarely get anymore, you know, especially with social media and especially with, you know, everybody jumping on their phones to film this. I'm not sure about you, but like I film things or take photos of things, and I haven't looked at those photos or videos for years, if at all. you know, I just film it. I'm like, cool, got it. And then I forget about it. And it kind of takes us out of the moment. It takes us out of the experience and kind of puts us more as documentarians as opposed to people that are actually experiencing something that's happening. So what we try to do is kind of let everybody just take a step back and say, hey, wait a minute, we're here now. What a unique experience to be alive in this moment together, sharing this experience. And let's kind of just really double down and just focus on the here and now.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember where you would take your film from your camera to the photo mat and then wait for it to be developed, and then it came back.
Yeah.
And then you'd relive those memories and then still kind of put them
away.
Yeah,
now it's just you take the photos and I have 10,000 photos that I have no idea what they are.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that's just, I mean, my parents actually are photographers, so I grew up in a dark room. And so I know the value of, you know, photo bit by bit going and, you know, and just developing one photo at a time. But that kind of experience is no longer really a part of the culture now, for better or for worse.
Tell me a little bit more about the collaborations that you have, the guest artists. You mentioned Priya Darshini, who will be appearing at the Harmony of the Woods concert. What are some other collaborations that you've done, and why is it important for the group to incorporate these other sounds or voices?
Yes, great question. On the record, we feature, like you had mentioned, Antonio Sanchez, who's absolutely, you know, one of the best drummers alive. He's in Pat Metheny's group. He did the score for Birdman. He's just like, you know, kind of a legend. We're big fans, and we're connected, you know, through the New York music scene, and just kind of said, hey, here's what we're thinking. And he's like, oh, this sounds amazing. So working with him has been incredible. And actually on all of our records, we didn't even realize this, but actually all of our albums have a different drummer, for the past, you know, 10 years or so. And that experience from Moto and myself's perspective really just means that even if we're playing the same song, it just, like we're talking about before, it kind of brings such a new light. And it's not just about the data. It's about like, let's just forget about all the rules and just kind of create for the sake of creation. I think that's probably the big picture answer to your question about why collaborate with all these other people. We have Mike Stern, also a legendary jazz guitarist, on the record as well. And we've done a bunch of different collaborations over the years, and it's just really to be able to kind of let go and see what this person brings to the table. It's a magical experience, and I think the audience is on board as well.
Well, and just to further emphasize your working with no rules, you've also scored an Emmy-winning documentary for ESPN, and you recently rescored 3 100-year-old French Dadaist-era silent films. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience. That was through Alamo Drafthouse and Ground Up Music. Alamo Drafthouse is a movie theater where they maybe have like, you know, 20 or 30 theaters around the country. They serve, you know, dinner, and it's like a really nice experience. And during COVID, they partnered with Ground Up Music, our music label, and said, hey, let's look at these public domain films, and would you want to rescore any of them? And so we got really excited about all the Dadaist movement from the 1920s, and the three films we chose, actually one is from 1902, God, it's the first sci-fi movie ever made, the Voyage dans la Lune, the Voyage to the Moon. So some people might recognize like the rocket ship in the moon's eye.
Yeah.
I think even the Smashing Pumpkins like use that imagery. But we did that film, and then we did kind of one of the more prolific or famous films called Ballet Mécanique. And that kind of informed actually this album itself here. I mean, it's creation for the sake of creation. At that time, they were doing stuff that had never been done before in film. And they were running up against a lot of, you know, people in the art world that were, you know, gatekeeping and saying, this is what art ought to be. And their kind of answer was, you know, says who, you know, and why don't we just create for the sake of making something for the moment? And that really informed actually what, we've been doing since, and definitely this record as well.
Really parallels your philosophy as well as House of Waters, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, it's like, why are we so stuck up on what things ought to be? I don't know where these things came from. You know, it's like somebody suggested it sometime, someplace, and then it kind of just gets stuck there because it's probably a good idea. And then 100 years go by, you know,
yeah.
And it's like, oh, whoops, you know? And so I think, you know, that movement and that kind of philosophy is something that really resonates with us. And I don't think we're alone in that. I think now there's actually a large awakening in a variety of different art fields of people saying, hey, everything can be anything. You know, let's just try new stuff. And in the age of kind of the constant, inundation of information, I think getting a little out of that and just saying, hey, let's just make something without judgment, without having it judged, just for the process of, you know, becoming. That's actually the name of the record. It's called On Becoming.
House of Waters is playing at Harmony in the Woods Friday at 6 in Hawley. There's more information on ticket information at harmonyinthewoods.org. Max ZT, thank you so much for joining us this morning and, talking to us about just, you know, living in the moment with the music and your, you know, innovation of this instrument that's rarely heard to your particular instrument, the hammered dulcimer. On the way out, I just want to play a little bit more on Becoming. How about, we play, The Wall with, features Priya?
That sounds great.
Okay. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
House of Waters featuring Priya Darshini from their Grammy-nominated album On Becoming. They're playing at Harmony in the Woods on Friday. There's more information about the group at houseofwaters.com. When we come back, more music, the music of Linda Ronstadt, locally here in Calicoon on Saturday. We'll have more from culture reporter Valerie Manzi next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're with Radio Catskill. Linda Ronstadt has released over 30 studio albums and has had 38 Billboard Top 100 singles, won 11 Grammy Awards, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014, among many, many other accolades. She announced her retirement from performing in 2011. She's no longer able to sing due to progressive supranuclear palsy. She turned 78 on July 18th. The Karen Hudson River Band performs Linda Ronstadt's classic 1978 album, Living in the USA and More, at Rafter's Tavern Saturday. Here with more is culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to Karen Hudson.
Hello, Karen, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, how are you?
Well, it's nice to have you back again. We haven't interviewed you in a while, so it's time to catch up with what you've been up to and what's coming up this weekend at Rafter's Tavern on Saturday, July 27th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Rafter's Tavern in Calicoon. You will be performing Linda Ronstadt tribute. So,
yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Is this the first time you'll be performing it in our neck of the woods?
It is the first time. We first did this show 2 years ago at the Triad Theater in New York City on the Upper West Side. Lovely little theater, and had a great response and did it again. We did this tribute again this past March. And I really wanted to bring it up to a fun venue up here, particularly Rafter's, because I like the place very much. And to, you know, share the the wealth of Linda Ronstadt songs and her catalog and just the fun of and upbeat rock and roll tunes and with my friends and fans up here.
What drew you to Linda Ronstadt, aside from what you just said?
Well, I grew up in the 70s, and I listened to radio all the time, and Linda Ronstadt was on the air all the time. My older sister listened to her a lot, and I wound up buying records and also listening to my sister's collection as well and singing along to her on the radio while driving around and singing into a brush after school.
Of course, I remember the brush. We all did that, even those of us who didn't go on to become singer-songwriters.
Hey, everyone should sing into a brush every now and then.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. So this has always been on your mind since you started performing to do a tribute to Linda Ronstadt?
Interestingly enough, it's almost like I'm finally doing what I've always wanted to do, which is have a rock band and just sing and sing tons of cover songs. And I mean, I used to play, so for many years, I've been a singer-songwriter and band leader of the Karen Hudson River Band and doing mostly my music, which is country rock, Americana, and Linda Ronstadt music blended in well with all the sets that I've performed. So inevitably, two or three songs of hers would wind up in a set list where I was performing. But growing up, other than, singing into a brush, I also would audition for theater productions in high school using a Linda Ronstadt song, which was kind of offbeat for, usually they'd probably expect me to sing like a musical tune or something, but I would sing a Linda Ronstadt song because that's what I knew. And so growing up, I always wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and I didn't really pursue that until much later on. And I felt like now is like sort of like time to do what I've always wanted to do, which is do an entire Linda Ronstadt album. And I chose Living in the USA because I listen to it the most. It has a lot of great hits on it. I love the combination of songwriters and the musicality on the album. And it's sort of like a walk through the past musically, starting with a great Chuck Berry tune. And so that's why I love this album. But I also, she's got a huge catalog of wonderful material, Grammy, award material, platinum selling material. And it'll be so much fun because it has been fun to share it with people. And not a lot of people are, performing her repertoire. There are some people, there's someone in New Jersey, I believe, and other, people here and there. But anyway, it's very close to my heart, and it feels great to sing the songs and to play with this wonderful band.
And what band is that?
So I've fronted the Karen Hudson River Band my whole, life, and they've always been a different lineup of players. A particular one is super hot, Mike Ornatel on guitar, and he was in The Left Bank and Moby Grape and The Monks. And he's a great, vocal arranger and mm-hmm. guitar player. And Charlie Roth is on keyboards. He's played with Ozzy Osbourne, music director with Ellen Foley, and a band that he was in the 90s, a pop band called Blessed Union of the Souls, had like a number one pop song on the charts. These guys play together along with, all the time in a band called Murderer's Row, which also includes Tommy DeVito on drums. And these guys work together like a well-oiled machine. And their specialty is really recreating great old records. Nice. And so it's really great to have them aboard. My friend Jeff Gordon's playing on bass, and Shunak Mara is playing on the guitar. And then I'm going to have a guest, Alexis Schroeder, is going to be singing a couple of songs from Linda Ronstadt's Mexican repertoire. And we just rehearsed today here at my house, and it's great. And we have a really great rapport, and she's really fun. to sing with, and we're going to do an Emmylou Harris, Linda Ronstadt duet as well.
Oh, wonderful.
So we're not just going to be doing the Linda Living in the USA, or also the second set is going to be all Linda's hits or songs that I like that are country rock songs.
Now, you are also a songwriter yourself, and you've had a number of albums.
I recorded 3 albums. My first one was called Bittersweet. The second was called Hudson River View. And that was kind of an EP. It has a Hank Williams and a Patsy Cline cover on it, a couple of my own songs, and a song called Nicotine. And then my third album is called Sonic Bloom, which came out a while ago, 10 years ago.
Is it 10 years? I remember when it came out. My goodness.
Yeah, so, you know, we made some traction with that one. It was really great to record that one. My CD release party was also in Manhattan and at the North Branch Inn. That was fun. Were you at that one at the North Branch?
I believe I was, yes.
That was a great time.
It was a great evening. Is there anything else you would like to add before we conclude?
Well, July 15th was Linda Ronstadt's birthday, and this is her birth month, so I just want to bring people together to love and appreciate her music. I find it interesting how there are people who are really not that much younger than me who are not familiar with her music, so hopefully we'll pass that her great music on to other people and make them become new fans. Because she certainly was, you know, and is the, one of the queens of rock and roll. We want to do right by her. Unfortunately, we know that she's not singing anymore, but we want to celebrate and honor her during her birth month.
Karen Hudson will be doing her tribute to Linda Ronstadt at Rafter's Tavern in Calicoon this coming Saturday, 7 to 9 p.m. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. Take care, Val.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that. And before we go, StoryCorps is the program, or What's All Smell with StoryCorps is the program we've been telling you about, where we bring strangers with different political beliefs together for a conversation, not to debate politics, but to get to know each other as people. Here's a conversation from Cassandra and Dave, who participated in the One Small Step conversation in Birmingham, Alabama.
Ask you this. When you read my bio, what did you think? And please be as honest as you feel comfortable, because nothing bothered me.
So the first part, my mind kicked into stereotype, which is probably dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. End of story. Second part was intriguing, because you said something along the lines of an open mind. I thought, well, this will be interesting.
When I read your bio, I just thought you were a white man. I thought I was going to come in here and just...
I don't even remember what it was.
And that's what's so interesting to me, is that I'm just like...
Stereotype.
That's exactly right. So I have to admit it, and I appreciate you receiving that and allowing me to admit my stereotype, because when you walked in the door and you stood up and introduced myself, I was like, oops. I don't feel threatened. I hope you don't feel threatened. Once we leave this conversation, I believe we'll have other conversations with others, may revisit, maybe your wife and my husband and 4 of us can get together and continue a conversation. But my point is that, what are we afraid of?
And that's an example of some of the conversations that we're trying to get together for One Small Step. You can be a part of it. And Isabel Braverman, who's helping us coordinate and facilitate these conversations, will be at the E.B. Crawford Public Library in Monticello tomorrow at 2 to explain more and to take your questions. There'll even be a drawing for a door prize and some light refreshments. That's tomorrow at the E.B. Crawford Public Library in Monticello. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
This is Ari Shapiro with NPR. If you've been thinking about helping this station with a contribution, but now is not the right time for a financial gift, you can donate a vehicle you don't need. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Think about it, and thanks.
Go to WJFFradio.org.
On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.